This is Meredith Sisko for these Ozark Hills. Here we are at August. Imagine that. Even the word August sounds serious. Two-thirds of the year gone, and yet it seems we have the largest part, the most important part, still to go. We got a good start on Tuesday announcing our opinions at the ballot box, but from now to November it's looking to be a long and noisy time full of bombast and puffery and a few meaningful moments, we hope, but very little actual augustness. Well, that thought takes me all the way back to that word again, August, a name straight from the Latin, or Augustus, as it's more commonly used. It comes from the Latin augere, or auger, meaning to increase, defined in the Latin as meaning esteemed, consecrated, or venerable. It was the title given to several Roman emperors. Someone or something that is august is said to be dignified and impressive. It occurs to me that that description is so seldom used today, perhaps because there are so few who meet the description. There are a few. John Lewis was one. He died recently after a long illness, but a much longer struggle. He was the last of a group I first encountered in my youth. You know, back in the days when I still knew everything. I was a sophomore in college at the school that would one day be called Missouri State University. Back then, it wasn't even a university. I was living in unapproved housing, meaning that the landlord or lady didn't live on the premises and so couldn't protect my, what, ability to sleep safely? I didn't quite get it, as the male students could have slept under a bridge for all anyone cared. I was studying music in the daytime, hanging out with a more lively bunch of theater majors after hours, and processing the wisdom, such as it was, of a newly discovered author, Ayn Rand. She advocated arrogance as a virtue, disregard for the petty plights of others, and a refusal of responsibility for anyone other than oneself, on the grounds that we smart ones were just too smart to bother with all that brother's keeper stuff. And then somebody shot the president. No one in my family had voted for him. They never voted for anyone that wasn't a Republican. This was, of course, in the days when the Southern Democrats were Dixiecrats, into slavery and Jim Crow and low ways in general. And we were the party of Lincoln. But we also bought into talk of that awful Catholic who took orders from the Pope and so couldn't be trusted, just like Adlai Stevenson before him, that Northern Democrat who couldn't be trusted because they said he was too smart. He might do anything. So that president was shot dead. That, for me, was the day that everything in the world changed, when that earnest young man who said, "Ask what you can do for your country," paid with his life in answer to that question. For the next 5 years, I watched my world crack open and spill out all these struggles that I'd known nothing about. On my grandmother's 10-inch black-and-white TV, I watched as the black-and-white disappeared in the face of unspeakable acts against those we called colored. I saw John Lewis get beaten with billy clubs on that bridge. I saw the young people dressed respectfully and acting responsibly being washed away with fire hoses and set upon by dogs. And somewhere in all that, I cracked open my volume of Ayn Rand, and I discovered that her words now sickened me. I became aware that neither I nor the slain president nor anyone else was an island entire of itself. We were, in that hour, and for a long time afterward, not a nation of parties, but a nation of mourners. My mother, a fourth-generation Republican and the village postmaster, had me help her sew the black bunting around the American flag before it could be flown again on the Monday after Kennedy's assassination. By Monday, Lee Oswald and Jack Ruby had also been shot dead. And the nightmare would continue far longer than we could imagine. One day a man came into the cafe joking about the assassination, and a prominent Republican man slapped him down, saying, "He is our president, and you'll not disrespect him." And so it went. By 1967, both my parents had died. I had fled the Ozarks and was alone in San Francisco. My friends were journalists and activists and people of proud color, and I watched again as the free speech, anti-war, women's rights, civil rights, and other movements blossomed in that cauldron despite overwhelming police violence, clubbing journalists and students with black lives again taking the biggest hits. Certainly there was good on each side, and evil. But change was as determined to happen as its opponents were determined to stop it. Of course, that was a long time ago, and much has happened in between. But today, those scenes play out in my head every time I watch the news. It's sometimes difficult to see the differences from then to now, and that worries me. For as we approach another decision when we will be called on to participate in our country's fate, I remember that long time ago, that little while, when we managed to become genuinely nonpartisan, just Americans. And I pray we still have the gumption, the wherewithal, the augustness, if you will, to search for the best in us, that call to country, in the midst of all pandemics and posturing. Perhaps it's time, in these most august of days, to ask ourselves again what we, the people, can do for our country.
Time to pay attention to growing things deep in the.
And you can keep up with master storyteller and folklorist Meredith Sisko on her website, meredithsisko.com. You can also find her essays archived on our website, ksmu.org, under the Programs tab.
Of life always running through these Ozark hills.